Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hey, friends, it's me again.
And Brian Brushwood.
Oh, yes, yes, y'all.
So, gentlemen, there was a interesting discovery this year, which was the what we believe may be an ancient hominid called Homo naledi, which is the naledi, N-A-L-E-D-I, pronounce it as you wish, where they found this inside of a cave in South Africa. We talked about this before, this very narrow passage. It was called Superman's Crawl, where you had to put one arm in front of the other, and it was this very precarious way to get in there. At the bottom of it, they found a bunch of fossils that looked deliberately placed, and the fossils don't quite match up precisely with anything else. They're still trying to figure out when they were placed there, why they were there, etc., but it was a fascinating discovery, and John Hawks, who has a really good blog about evolution and covering all sorts of ancient origins, who I followed for years, is one of the principal researchers on this. So it was kind of really cool to realize that, oh, this person I've been reading was secretly working on this. Anyhow, there was a bit of controversy that's just happened over this, and that they in the very lengthy report, they had something like 1,500 total specimens or 1,500 bones that they found that they've been going through and cataloging. And it was a really interesting archaeological excavation because they had a team of just – it ended up being a team of female climbers who were able to go down in there and find it, not because they selected for that, but just because the people who offered, who had the skill set to do it, that's how it turned out. So it was this really kind of cool – group of young people going in there and doing it, and a very interesting discovery. And they're still trying to make sense of this stuff. They've been hesitant to date any of it. And then all of a sudden, we get a little controversy.
What could be controversial? This isn't some kind of creationist thing, right? They're not claiming it's like science at its finest. We're understanding our natural world and the descendants that brought us here.
Well, now what happened is Michael Shermer, who we all know, Michael Shermer, Skeptic Magazine. Michael Shermer, as a friend, I like Michael Shermer, has in a writer for Scientific America, has criticized, I would say kind of a little bit harshly, saying that, hey, did they just quickly discount the idea that they could have met a violent death? Because Shermer points out that so many ancient hominid species are hominid interactions, just that if you go into the further back you go look at grave sites, the more likely you're going to find that they met some sort of violent death. And Shermer saying, hey, maybe this was murdered and this wasn't really, they didn't really address this and et cetera. And so was also sort of made a criticism about the journal they published it in, where he didn't go for, it wasn't a more mainstream journal, it was eLife, et cetera. So it was a kind of a critical attack almost of this. And yeah. John Hawks has said, replied to this. He's like, hey, if you look into the report, you'll see that we looked at every single bone for any evidence of violence, of trauma, of tooth marks, or anything else like that. So we have ourselves a little science.
Well, okay, so I'm
a little science slap fight. Well, get in the ring, boys.
So in which corner is which position? Walk me through this again.
So Shermer's position, Shermer's article, I should say, kind of criticizes the speed at which it was released and suggest that they overlooked or didn't really consider the idea that it could have been they were put there because they met some sort of violent end and were stashed there.
So you're saying like he's saying it could have been that there was a rock slide and the heads got dashed and
they were murdered. They were murdered.
That they murdered each other because that is, I guess, prevalent enough that it should have been addressed more prominently in the write-up, right?
Correct.
Well, and what's the counter position?
The counter position is, hey, no, we actually looked at every single – if you read our full report, you'll see that we looked at all the bone fragments for any evidence of that kind of trauma, and we found none. And he's sort of saying – kind of saying, hey, back off. No, that was paragraph 45. Did you look?
Well, and so if not murder, then what is the default, the null hypothesis on this?
Well, it's just that they may have met some sort of natural – end, and then they were deposited there. And Shermer's point, and it's one that we all agree with, is that we have this. There's a too idyllic view of how ancient peoples lived, is we ignore how often they met violent deaths, and sometimes they'll say, yeah, no, those deaths weren't actually fine. They didn't die from war. It was just one person in the village was on a revenge thing. It's like, well, if 50% of the bodies we dig up prior to 2,000 years ago, et cetera, whatever, met violent deaths, that means that you were more likely to die a violent end than today.
So when the initial report was published, what was the newsworthy angle of it? Because is this a case where Michael Shermer just read the article and he's like, whoa, you're missing the juiciest part of this right here? And they're saying, no, it's not that juicy.
No, I think he's criticizing the science of it. You know, he's saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, that like, you know, like, oh no, you missed this. Your write-up of this important find is incomplete because you didn't account for murder.
That would be the Shermer's point of view, and the rebuttal is, no, actually we did. We did look for these things that you said that we didn't.
So is this the case of Shermer maybe not reading things so well, or?
I don't know. I he's a thorough guy. I think it's certainly going to be interesting, and I sent this to my friends who know Michael and who know Hawks and all this, and it was the Bill Hader eating popcorn gif, because like these people are all far more brilliant than I am and know way more about the topic than I do. But it was a very interesting, because like, hey, here's this guy I really dig, John Hawks, who's doing really interesting research, and here's this other guy I really dig, Michael Shermer, who's just opened my mind about a lot of things, and all of a sudden this clash. You know, like, wow.
I guess I'm just surprised that it doesn't seem like a very clash-worthy thing to disagree about, where it's like, let's say that paragraph wasn't in there and that he didn't account for it possibly being an assault. It doesn't seem like that's the kind of thing I would write. I don't want to call it a hit piece, but certainly like a confrontational article,
full court, right? Like it's like your hashtag shots fired.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like I don't know that I would come out guns a blazing, just be like, did you consider this? Ex murderer.
Shermer writes, instead of publishing in Science or Nature, the prestigious journals in which major new fossil human finds are typically announced, the authors unveiled their discovery in eLife, an open access online journal that fast tracks the peer review process. Instead of meticulously sorting through the 1,550 fossils belonging to at least 15 individuals for many years, as is common paleoanthropology, the analysis was published a mere year and a half after the discovery, November 2013 and March 2014. What triggered my skepticism, however, was the scientist's conjecture that the site represents an example of deliberate body disposal, which, as the media read between the lines, implies an intentional burial procedure. This, they concluded, was the likeliest explanation compared with four other hypotheses.
So this is a case where Michael Shermer feels like he's helping to build the dam to hold back the tide of bad scientific writing, and that good procedures would be to take longer, to be more thorough, and to release to more respected journals. Instead, he's seeing some slippage to a less respected journal, and an example of what he's catching is the fact that this wasn't addressed.
Well, the problem is that Hawks says, no, we did do this thorough. Hawks is saying you wanted a year and a half, but we went through, we put a tremendous amount of that resource into this. He's like, read the paper, you know, read our paper at how detailed we went into the analysis of the fossils. You're tripping. He says, you're throwing out this hypothesis of violence. He says, and that's one that we addressed, and one of the things we specifically looked for was that. And that's the criticisms, like, is that this is, you know, again, I don't, you know, I don't have a hominid in this fight, but I see, I read the Shermer thing first. I'm like, well, this is an interesting sort of take. And I have not read the Hawks paper. I read his overview coverage of it. I've not read the detailed thing because partially I wouldn't understand it. But Hawks is, and his rebuttal to this, which is worth reading, is saying, hey, one, you're picking on us for choosing eLife, which is he says it's a respectable journal to do it. It's a newer one. It's one of these things that is very open access. And he says, two, is you have this criticism that we didn't do a thing, but there's the thing where we did the thing that you said we didn't do.
How much of this is about the journals?
Yeah.
Like, how much of this, it kind of just feels like this is on a blog and not a newspaper, and therefore I look at it scancy pants.
I think might be more it might be more. There's another player. There's somebody else involved here.
A third man?
Oh, wait. So you're saying that somebody calls and you're like, this guy's doing a thing. He's cutting out my journal.
Eh. I might think that not relating to the journal specifically, but more to it might be that Shermer has contacts or knows people. My guess would be that because he needs. Some of the best presentations I've gotten on anthropology have been things that he's put on, that were accessible to me. And I know that he's very in touch with that community. And it might very much be that there might be other people who are like, hey, yeah, no, we have some issues there. But he might be vocalizing that. Again, I'm putting words in his mouth. And again, Shermer.
Sure, yeah.
Shermer,
and there's only
this is going to Shermer is wonderful at encouraging debate and responding to these things. And that's what's going to make this interesting is that, he will have a response. He's very good at giving other people an opportunity to hear this. So, I can't speak highly enough of him.
How much do you think this exact paper gets published in a different journal? Do you think that we would have seen this level of criticism?
Well, part of the thing is we can't.
Although I guess that's a chicken and egg thing because he's right. Like, oh, to publish it in the journal, you would have to have this level of rigor.
Correct.
The absence for which is part of the reason why you're writing it.
Right. Right. But again, in a larger sense, though, this is kind of the debate that we see between Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica, and I wonder how much. Universally, attitudes are changing as far as respectability because, there was one study at one point that found that Encyclopedia Britannica had about as many errors as Wikipedia. But the difference was when the study came out, Wikipedia fixed those errors within like 30 seconds, whereas Encyclopedia Britannica did not. And I don't know. Is it a place where is it the madness of the crowds or the wisdom of the crowds to take advantage of a more open platform where people could fast track their ideas out to the world?
Some of these journals and even some of the established ones, it's been shown how easy it is to often get things published and completely BS things. And I don't know that I would say that there have been a number of issues where I've questioned the credibility of Scientific America or Nature magazine when they get into a philosophical or some sort of political point of view. That they're not going to deviate from. And to hold them as being, hey, you should take it seriously. But the fact that like Science and Nature are the two ones that that you'd suggest, and not Scientific America, but Science and Nature. And they've committed some great sins in my view in some cases. But as far as this, I think that the picking on the source had to do more with his Shermer suggestion that this was just released too quickly. Yeah. But there's the alternate point of view is it's fine to be quick if you put everything out there and also if you voice whatever criticisms. And we criticized the NASA arsenic announcement because that was something that as soon as it came out there within days, there were really credible criticisms of that. And it seemed like it may have been a case of cherry-picking your referees or cherry-picking the people you go to for counterpoints of view. Mm-hmm. And here, Shermer is critical of a point of view, of we are critical to, of this, hey, you know, these people lived happy lives, it was great, and now we have this dissent where we know, objectively speaking, that humanity is more moral, you're less likely to die from violence than ever. But that's not an attitude. We're gonna get a speech on guns from our president, despite the fact that gun violence, gun homicides are declining, have been declining for decades, yet the perception is that we're at this critical mass. And that's frustrating, when you're like Shermer, a public speaker talking about these topics, and it's like, no, this is the way it is, and if you don't address that, then we're gonna keep building this inaccurate picture of how the world works.
And, how they covered it back in hominid times.
Oh, yes. Man. Do you remember those reports? Because all of a sudden, in walks Ugdog, who's got like a bashed-in skull. And meanwhile, Glaktar is all like, he's grunting, like he knows for sure. And then and Nancy Grack is all, she's pointing fingers left and right. And everybody's tuned in over here. Meanwhile, Sheriff Ugblug was he hadn't even finished his forensic investigation yet. He was trying to match up, he's grabbing rocks and holding it up to the hole in his head.
And you want to know what? It's all because of the almighty sand dollar or pep.
That's right, man. It's like when it comes down to it, it's all about them seashells. Am I right? Them pretty baubles to give to the ladies.
Exactly, when they would go ahead and throw to a commercial for patreon.com/weirdthings.
As old as murder, patreon.com. yeah, man, support our show. Head on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. If you enjoy the show exactly 20 cents per episode, well, then we'd like to have 20 cents per episode. If you enjoy it a buck a show, well, then you're a better person than we thought you were, and we take back three things we said about you that one time. Just head on over, join the club, and know that you're making a difference. You're going to be keeping us regular. You're like the Metamucil to our podcasting bowel movements.
You're... support is fibrous and well received. Thank you very much. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
This week via this was actually originally from May 31st, and it just popped up again, and it was Matt Novak on Paleo Future Gizmodo points to a article that goes into explaining how investors should be, a warning to airship investors from 1908.
Oh, fantastic. This is great. I mean, this, so we think we have space fever right now. We got, you know, space ventures getting ready to capture meteors and mine them. And we got self-landing rockets that are ready to fire off again the moment they land. We got the big space race. This has to be nothing compared to airship fever back at the turn of the 20th century.
Let me read you some of this. This is from the original editorial. So as far as the possibilities of freight transportation are concerned, it may be passed with a word. Wherever ordinary methods of transportation on land are available, it will be absurd to carry goods of any sort through the air. The cost of such transport would be measured not in mills per ton mile, as in rail or carriage, but in cents per ton mile, as in wagon haulage, but in dollars or hundreds of dollars per ton. It is true that for exploration in difficult country, as over the Arctic ice or in rough mountain regions, there are possibilities in the airship, but such, of course, is rather scientific than commercial.
I mean, goes on. In his defense, we do measure air freight in dollars or hundreds of dollars. I mean, he's spot on in that regard.
But he was, 5 years later, we're using it for mail.
Right.
I mean, yes. Like, yes, we now, you know, we
measure everything
currency
in dollars now.
Right.
But even within a decade when he said that, they were already saying, you know what, getting mail and other things back and forth faster. So
no,
what
about passengers? I love this. I want this to be a news segment, just historical haters. Haters through.
Oh, my God. Yeah, what would be great is to read. That would be a fun game. That maybe we should do it on Night Attack sometime when we have Andrew on again. We could do a bit where you read the hysteria, leaving out what the subject is, and you have to place, like, what is it they're terrified of and put it in the right historical context.
Now, in the same article, this is from Novak reporting. The article continues by laying out the impracticality of passenger air travel, seen as more of an amusement that might be useful at fares rather than as a practical means of transportation. Interestingly, the author also calls out the high-speed automobile as a toy of the rich, which allows them to vent their surplus energies.
Dude.
And I've had on Twitter, I say something about Elon Musk. I'm like, yeah, we're just making cars for rich people. I'm like, well, this Model 3 is going to be $35,000. Like, well, that's the price of like a Mercedes. I'm like, listen, if you think $35,000 is a rich person's vehicle, then I don't know what to tell you.
Dude, I'll tell you what this makes me think of is this quote. The children now love luxury. They have bad manners, contempt for authority. They show disrespect for elders, and they love chatter in place of exercise.
Oh, my God. I love that he went full get off my lawn. Like, it's just like it has to devolve even to, you know, youth gone wild.
Do you guys have a guess as to who said it?
I mean, that was attributed, I think, to Socrates.
Yeah. So it is. But I believe it.
That's not from that.
No. I do believe it's misattributed to Socrates, because when I saw it, I wanted to say it was like not Cicero, one of them old. Anyway, it's allegedly from, there we go. Snopes.com says Socrates. Well, it says it's pointed out in the Snopes forums that Socrates never wrote anything. So if anything, it would have been Plato quoting Socrates.
Quoteinvestigator.com.
Quote investigator, well done.
Has determined that the author of the quote is not someone famous or ancient.
What?
Oh. It was crafted by a student, Kenneth John Freeman, in 1907.
Yeah, that's still old. Still counts. Still works.
Yes.
So wait, is there anything else in this this airship hysteria?
So he discounts one, the idea of using it for passenger travel.
Okay.
For the carriage of passengers, the necessary risks attendant upon flight through the air, either with the dirigible balloon or the aeroplane, are certain to limit passenger traffic to the field of sport and amusement. This is, of course, a much more considerable field than is often realized. The public is willing to pay very high prices for mere amusement. And so he describes that, but explains that the experience of high-speed automobile has proved the existence of a very large leisure class of wealthy men who find vent for their surplus energies in undertaking all sorts of risky exploits. Flight through the air may very likely become popular as a fad for a few years hence as auto racing is today, but it'll have just as little relation to the serious, practical, everyday business of carrying freight and passengers for the great workday world as have the 100-horsepower automobiles that break the speed records in France and America. He's wrong on two things.
So here's the thing. Like, we should have, like, a Luddite's guide to making predictions or polemics about what will and will never be done. It's like, make sure to qualify.
Wayne, why it's no use for military applications either.
Yeah, right. Well, understand that in general, it's a bad idea to bet against human ingenuity for just about anything. And you should always, I'm going to say always, you should always avoid saying never in your thing, or it's like, it will not.
That's definitely a good point. I mean, really. He definitely misses wildly on not necessarily betting against ingenuity, right, but just that technology. He did not feel that airships, which to be as fair as we can to him, he seems to mean half as much, as much about dirigibles as he does airplanes, right? And dirigibles have not necessarily seen their day in our modern society.
That's correct. But I mean, just look, if you're going to say things that won't happen, put a time limit on it. That's a good idea. Say by 1916. I highly doubt.
Andrew, why don't you go ahead and read this? I'm sorry. I'm trying to cape up for you, but here we go. He just keeps putting his foot in his mouth so many years ago.
It is said that leading military nations are vying with each other at the present time in the development of military airships, but this has not proved that these structures can be made practically useful in the serious business of actual warfare. Of all the apparatus ever proposed for use on the battlefield, a flying machine is beyond all question the most vulnerable. It offers an ideal mark to the bullets of the enemy. Its limitations of weight forbid its protection by any sort of armor. Had the flying machine been developed 40 or 50 years ago when projectiles were limited to small velocities and short ranges, it might have performed some service in observing the enemy's forces, but with modern infantry rifles discharging projectiles with initial velocity of 2,700 feet per second and with light artillery fitted to the discharge of perfect hailstorm of bullets, have an equal velocity and range, the rise of an airship at any point within several miles of a hostile army would be merely the signal for its immediate destruction.
Well, good thing air combat never went anywhere.
Yeah, it's no such thing as air superiority, apparently.
Wow. Yeah, that one, we got it wrong. Great moments in history.
And it's just for something around 1908 that within less than 10 years... quickly that became not correct. And then by the time we get to the Second World War, how decisive air power was in much of the campaign and how that's just totally changed the frontiers of warfare was just aerial bombing. And even then, dirigibles actually played a part to an part of it. So this was the next year the official Wright brothers were testing a military airplane.
Wow. That is amazing.
That's amazing. That's great.
But and to the defense of this guy, looking at this thing, you're like, well, that's not going to be very practical, And that's the problem is that we project the future as just a larger version of the present.
Well, and that's the thing is it's not what we know, it's what we don't know and can't mm-hmm. possibly predict, right? When you are up against the human ingenuity of not just one person, but the rest of the world versus, you look at what's available now and you're like, I can't picture this possibly being of military value. Therefore, I feel safe in proclaiming that it can't possibly happen. But you're pitting yourself against all of the military inventors for the next however many years, trying to come up with ideas that you never would have thought of. And in that regard, it's a safer place to assume that there's no way for you to outwit them.
Let me ask you guys a question. Is in reading this guy and kind of laughing at him to an extent, what have we been critical of? And I'm trying to think, what have I been downplaying? What have I been critical of that might be, oh, yeah, later on, like, well, Andrew, remember when you made fun of this? Certainly Space Elevator.
Space, God darn it.
Yeah, but I mean, I went from a fan of that to, wait, if we have reusables, then that's that. When Space Elevator seemed like the only game in town, then that was, wow, well, that's the thing. And now that we really suspect that it's not, and then I haven't thrown out like a Space Elevator maybe a several hundred years from now kind of thing, when our materials technology is such to the point that we're not worried about the catastrophic failure problems or whatever, but I'll defend that and say there's just so many other
that seems like an Amazon thing. Like after UPS and FedEx have, you know, monopolized reusable rockets, Amazon's like, you know, we could save five quatlus on a shipment of a bleep blop, and if we just built a railway to space and profits.
Yeah, I guess for me the reason the parties I'm so dismissive of it is that it's a geoengineering project that has no parallel that's ever existed that would require a level of cooperation and everything else that's to me is just as limiting as it's not just if we have this thread that's strong. It's like that's the easy part to me. It's
right. Well, it's what to do when the thing collapses and whips itself around, breaking the sound barrier as the kinetic motion of orbit slams into it.
The sign on to doing this, but certainly Space Elevator is something that space tourism. I think space tourism would be like a $1 billion thing. I think it'll be an enterprise,
but that's
not
nothing compared to resource harvesting.
It's like that's the putting. We can get into resource harvesting in a second, but to me, the space tourism thing is kind of what he's talking about, like putting airplanes at carnivals and stuff. It's like, well, yeah, but that's not the real enterprise.
We have been very critical, and I mean we as in Andrew and I and not Brian, on one-way trips to Mars. We were very critical on the idea that that you would have one person go, not necessarily like settlement, right? Like not like putting the whole thing there, but like the first early explorers, like we were very critical that would not be seen as inspiring. Do you think that we'll eat those words?
Are you asking me or Andrew?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just bringing it up.
I don't think that anybody capable of doing a serious mission to Mars is going to do it as a one way, and so we will never get to know if we were wrong on that.
I disagree. Okay, so Elon Musk is what, mid-40s? So I'm picture 20 years from now, he now has revolutionized. And by the way, if we're talking about times we eat crow, I definitely have to eat crow over the superiority of reusable rockets over the long term. Highly unlikely, you know, in my lifetime, space elevator solution. I mean, you guys, in every way, ran the numbers in a way that they were just in. My position became indefensible, and I am definitely on team reusable rockets. But let's say 20 years from now, Elon Musk now has a fleet of say 100 to 500 rockets that are all reusable, and all of a sudden, the cost of getting something to orbit is about. A buck a pound, maybe we'll call it, you know,
15. I mean, I don't know how we get to a buck, but let's say 15.
Okay. 15 bucks per pound. He now has enough billions of dollars that he says, yeah, here's what'll happen is we're going to, I'm starting a flood of, one ship per week for the rest of my lifetime. And I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to let like, you know, a couple years of them go. They're going to drop packages of all kinds of stuff. We've got some robots. They're going to start building fuel. We'll have, you know, escape things or whatever. And he's like, and then 5 years into it, I'm going to be on one of those journeys. So around the time I'm 65, 70 years old, I'm going to land on Mars and I'm going to die on Mars. And, you know, I'll be using prepackaged food during all that time. Hopefully while I'm there, I'll set up enough pop tents to invite other people to come join me. But this resource train is just going to flood, and I'm going to be the first pioneer of Mars, and I'm going to die there. I absolutely believe that in our lifetime that could totally happen.
Yeah, but that's a different, totally different proposition than what had been suggested, and it wasn't by you. It was somebody, but the originally was, let's just use our existing resources to save money and just do a one-way trip there and not have to worry about bringing the person back.
Okay, so picture this, same scenario, but let's say a little bit earlier, let's say same scenario or same intent, but let's say Elon Musk says still has the same fleet, same cost to go there. He says, I was just diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor. I'm going to die in 4 years. I would like to spend those 4 years on Mars. So I'm going to go to Mars and die and be the first person to die on Mars. Like, I could see that.
My kids, I'm going to live on Mars and die there.
I could totally see that too. Or if not him, then some, you know, well-respected scientist or whatever.
Yeah, I understand. I guess for part of me, for me is when the Elon Musk is one of the first people to tear apart the one-way trip plan, because he's pointing out that, you know, the DNA of Elon Musk is, no, let's figure out what if you can do this thing and then do this other thing that people thought was impossible, then you can actually do it, then you can go this way. And like, yeah, I absolutely can see that if somebody had the means to do it, you know, and said, hey, I'm going to die, that's fine. But again, to me, that's a different proposition than, hey, let's just send somebody there one way, half-assed, without a return ticket to show that it could be done. For me personally, I go, man, what? Let's really put our brain power to do it and figure out how to bring you back, because then that's really inspiring.
I guess that is the biggest thing. And that's the only thing about this idea that I always keep getting hung up on, is that if we're at the point where somebody wants to go to Mars and spend a significant amount of time there, even at the risk that they might not come back, like, how far off are we in that world from being able to bring them back, or B, like, colonizing? Like, you know, because even in your scenario, like the resource train, he's looking at like, hey, look, I'm just the first dude, you know, I'm just Brigham Young saying this is the spot, and I want everybody else that, you know, wants to colonize Mars to come to colonize Mars with me. It's not the, like, hey, we're just going to, one dude's going to go there and his death will be a symbol.
I guess my whole opinion is that Mars is so difficult to get to. It's such a steep mountain to climb and get down to the other side that our appetite to go to Mars is greater than our scientific ability to go there and come back. And if I was going to make a stake bet now, it's that whoever the first human being to land on Mars is, dies on Mars. I don't see any, now whether he dies at a ripe old age after 30 years of being there as the first colonist, or whether it's a mishap happens and he doesn't make it back or whatever, it just seems like the odds are much, much higher of by the time we're ready to go, because they're at the bottom of the well. We can, once we get reusable rockets going, we could fling resources down to them, but the amount of resources it would take to fling down at the bottom of the well so that they could come out of the well and come back to Earth.
No, it's one-third gravity. It's we have the thing that landed a week ago would be able to take off from Mars.
Yes. And, well, I guess if you built a spacecraft that looped around and you did a similar
You got to look at the rumored plans for the Mars Colonial Transport. It's all part of the plan. I mean, if we were trying to go to another Earth with Earth-like gravity, I would say, yeah, that's really going to be much more challenging. But because it's got one-third gravity, escape velocity is very different there than it is here, that you can build a single ship to orbit or escape velocity Mars rocket. That can be done. But if it was an Earth to another Earth, I'm like, yeah, that's a hell of a more different proposition. But, you know, we went to the moon and came back with 1960s level technology, because getting off the moon was a hell of a lot easier than getting off Earth.
Right.
Well, there we go. People doing whatever sensory podcast 50 to 100 years from now. Somebody's right. Something's wrong. You can all laugh it up, guys.
Please,
agents.
Please be like, look up.
They didn't realize it was a simulation all along and just had to know the cheat code.
Yeah, I'm just going to put it out there. Please look up whatever artificial intelligence is meant to simulate my existing consciousness long after my desiccated corpse has evaporated into the wind, and tell that artificially intelligent entity that the person upon which he was based was correct.
Or wrong.
Or wrong.
So I know I've been skeptical about the arrival, the practicality arrival of autonomous cars. That I think that certainly we see them. They function. There was an article that came out that this hacker, hey, I came up with a car that's 99% as good as Google or Tesla's autonomous car. But I'm like, yeah, but that 1% is what is the difference between murder,
yeah,
and something that we're happy with. And I certainly think that it's going to be that bigger challenge. It's a very, it's a bigger challenge. And we've seen, we just saw in California, they passed legislature that says, hey, not only do you have to have a driver in a self-driving car, you're going to have a special license.
Do you feel like, I don't mind the special licensing part. I think that is, again, not my favorite, but I don't think it's unreasonable. Do you think that they are significantly—
For that on top of a regular driver's license?
Well, for example, you know, because there's special circumstances, and again, I'm not a fan of it. I would not wish for it, but
it would be like getting a motorcycle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You should take a day long course on things that you should know about your self-driving car that you don't need to know on a regular driving car. That seems reasonable to me. The requirement that you have to have a steering wheel and a brake and all those old fashioned things just seems like it's really limiting development of this go-to auto driving Uber thing that Google's trying to put together. That seems like you're really trying to limit the technology there.
I guess I look at that, and that special license is even more inhibiting, because a big goal of this is we have a population that gets older. We have substantial number of handicapped people with vision problems who have to rely on other people, that you're now saying, oh no, this is even further removed from you. You're because you can't get a driver's license. You really can't ride in one of these self-driving cars.
Well, yeah. Okay. My guess is that more realistically, I mean, again, as a society, we're so adverse to automating jobs. I think we're going to have essentially Uber drivers that do even less than Uber drivers, you know, who pretty much sit and read all day in a thing and make crap money.
You're not getting the cost advantage of getting rid of that driver.
Correct. But I do believe we're looking at a fleet of, I think they're going to put up with that in the short term, because what the world needs to see is a few years of the dramatic proof that robots are better drivers than people. And I think once they see it real quick, they're going to release or relax the legislative hiccups on there.
I hope that's the case, but remember, I've been in the skeptical position as far as how legislation's going to handle this, and was not edified to find out that California just decided to double down on my pessimism.
Well, but if anyone's going to, you know, jump the gun on the hand-wringing and come up with preemptive legislation, I mean, you know, Texas is going to wait until after they're covering the roads before they finally announce, yeah, no, this is fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, this also kind of seems like, you know, whenever anybody kind of gets into disrupting transportation, there seems to always be kind of laws that cover up for it, right? Or react to it. And we saw it with Uber, and I don't think that, you know, self-driving cars, the idea of eliminating drivers, will be anything different, you know? Like that's just, we're going to have to deal with, you know, this kind of stuff, you know, this kind of legislation. I think that's, you know, I don't know what changes it, though, because I don't think Brian, that like it's necessarily people will, that a switch will flip with people to say, oh wait, this is safer. I think that convenience will always be the first thing that kind of makes people think that this is something that, you know, we need to now bend laws to accommodate. But I don't know when that happens, and I don't know when it becomes something that's like, immediately like, oh, wow, that's super cool. I really like that. Like, is there a sliver? What is the inside lane for a self-driving car that makes people think like, oh, that's really cool. Like, is it just elder transport is saying like, hey, you know, we're going to have these lanes so elderly people can get around.
It could be a lot of things. Like, so I just drove this morning from St. Pete Beach to here. So it's about a 3.5-4 hour drive. And I would love to have spent that drive doing something other than driving. And if you broke down, if you had autonomous cars, you broke down the cost per mile or whatever, that becomes extremely competitive or efficient, and it becomes a different mode of transportation. And California is eager to spend trillions of dollars on a high-speed rail that won't connect anything that needs to be connected, that you'll still need cars to get to. It is a boondoggle. It's just watch the Simpsons episode. And I get in discussions with people like, oh, no, I'll be like, yeah, you're it's not going to go as fast as you want, and it's really about landowners and people, construction projects. It's about a cash. It's getting more money out of the government for projects that don't do anything versus, man, you know, coming up with some really good, sensible, practical things for this. What could happen if we had an amazing autonomous car transportation infrastructure that's being paid for by private corporations competing with each other?
Yeah, no, you'll get no disagreement from me there, man.
Yeah. Be cool.
So another thing that you 100 years from now can judge us for, we are making bold predictions and we want you to judge us.
Gosh, remember when they thought that moving faster than 20 miles an hour was a good idea? Didn't realize that it was adverse to your health and destroying the fabric of the space-time universe?
Exactly, yeah. That we're liquefying our organs by moving them at an unnatural rate of speed.
Picks?
Yeah, man, I got a pick. I'm reading a book, and maybe Bryce has hung around enough to tell me where I heard about it, but on one of the podcasts, or maybe it was an article I was reading, but somewhere it recommended Chasing the Scream about the beginning and end of the drug war, and it does a fantastic job of kind of explaining where the origins of Chasing the Scream is. It does a great job of explaining the difficulties, and I'm 2/3 of the way through the book now, and it's going through some of the scientific evidence that suggests that not just humans, but all animals seek the ability to alter their consciousness from time to time. The example they give is some mongooses
listening to the Doors.
They had a, there's one group of scientists that had a group of mongooses. They introduced a, some drugged thing. I want to say it was like LSD or something that all the mongooses tried. They got dizzy and then they avoided it. They avoided it like the plague for the next long time until one of the mongooses died. The other mongoose, encountering the corpse, decided it wanted to get wrecked and not be here at that moment, ran straight over and started taking the drugs. It's like, I got to get out of here. And the examples throughout the animal kingdom, from elephants eating fermented apples to toddlers spinning around and holding their breath to create a dizzy experience. It seems to be something universal. It's a fascinating book. Really, really interesting. Tells some harrowing tales of the collateral damage of the drug war. Very, very even-handed. I'm loving it. I'm loving it a lot, and I highly recommend it.
Excellent.
I got a pick here. It's the same. I think I picked this last week. I'm going to pick it again because I liked it so much. I have all but the season finale of Fargo season 2 to watch.
Oh, sweet.
I have liked it a lot. There was specifically, is it Nick Offerman?
Yeah, dude, yeah. Nick Offerman is gold in this.
This is a moment, listeners to this show, for which Nick Offerman has this kind of star turn episode where his character really comes front and center. And I'd like to imagine that he plays, without spoiling, this isn't really a spoiler, he's a lawyer and he is drunk. And he is called upon because he's the only lawyer in town to defend somebody. And a staggering, lyrical Nick Offerman defending the rights, I imagine to be the just like Brian. He lives inside Brian's brain. Like, you know, He is. It is the essence of every time Brian gets stopped at the TSA. Like, I think the Nick Offerman, you know, just going on and on about the jackbooted thugs and how we have rendered freedom from the English like blood from a stone. And now we it is up to us to protect it. You know, it's amazing. He's great. That episode specifically is one of my favorite just television episodes ever. It has everything that I love about it. And his character in that episode specifically is just great. Like, it just really showcases him as an actor. It's amazing, Fargo, like, that they are able to take everything you love about a Coen Brothers movie without the Coen Brothers and make it as good as it is. Like, it's almost, you know, I read one review of it that, like, it's kind of so good you sort of get dulled at how good it is, where it's like, oh, look at that perfectly framed shot. Like, oh, look at that amazing performance. Oh, look at that. Like, you kind of like, oh, I don't know if I'm connecting to these characters as much. Well, yeah, because it's an ensemble cast being used perfectly, where you're never really getting too much or too little of any of these amazing actors. It's great. I've loved it quite a bit, and I think everybody should watch it.
Dude, Mike Milligan. I could watch an entire series of just Mike Milligan doing Mike Milligan stuff.
And yeah, he's great, and I loved how they've I think on another show, he kind of would have become the Kramer, where you just, like, you're so fascinated by him that you want to stay on him.
Right.
The show has been at its benefit. Again, it's like you are always just getting the perfect amount of everybody.
What about you, Andrew?
I'm going to try to watch Fargo tonight. I've been it's like, shut up, everybody. All right, I get it.
Okay, so real quick, here's your question. Justin is doing the fascinating experiment of watching them out of order. He's starting with the one that chronologically happens first in the late 1970s, season two, and then he'll get to experience the offspring of Solverman, who's an important character in season one. Set in, I believe, what, 2005 or something?
I'm watching them in season order.
Okay. All right.
Not experimental like he is. I have a recommendation, and it is for you, gentlemen. And it's for all of our listeners, and a sincere recommendation that will elevate our discussion on certain topics on this show.
Okay.
I avoided this book for a while, and not the least of which because the cover looked like the worst, most boring O'Reilly's book ever. And I know that's a silly way to judge a book, but I'm like, man, that's just kind of not really kind of exciting or cool for the premise of what this book is going to be about. But nonetheless, I was looking for something to listen to while I drove back and forth to my best friend Ken Montgomery's wedding, not to be confused with my best friend Justin Robert Young's wedding earlier in 2015. This book deals with artificial intelligence, or more specifically, superintelligence by Nick Bostrom.
Superintelligence by Nick Bostrom. Is this an Audible joint that you're showing us?
This is an Audible book. So Bostrom is a philosopher. He's at Oxford. He's actually trained in economics, and it deals with, he goes through all the different scenarios by which we would develop highly intelligent machines, and he uses the term superintelligent, either from brain uploading to just computers, just creating them from, you know, simple computer programs that are seed programs that evolve into something more sophisticated. And it is I'm halfway into it, just an amazing overview of that, of all the ways at which we could arrive at there, then all of the problems that we can see. And he points out that, hey, these are the problems we see, but when we're talking about superintelligence, it's super intelligent. And how do you contain these things? How do you prevent them from causing harm? Would they want to cause harm?
All right,
and he gives examples of things of we talk about gray goo before, but you tell a super intelligent machine to say, hey, make paper clips. And it quickly realizes that it can turn the entire universe to computronium to figure out how to maximize the number of paper clips it can produce. And by the way, goodbye humanity, because you're
because I'm here to build paperclips.
Exactly. And he gets very much into that, and he does a very good example of explaining how we tend to try to anthropomorphize intelligences like our own, and he says there's no reason to think that they would behave like us. And we've had this argument back and forth, you know, Brian and I, about would they see us as their parents or whatever, and he describes these are utterly alien intelligences that have no concept of those things, or that those concepts are no more meaningful to them than your relationship to you and your fingernails. And that's my example. And also the problems, and it's a very interesting problem, is you say, okay, well, let's build one of these artificial intelligence inside of a box, inside of a sandbox, and we'll find out if it's moral or not. And he's like, well, a evildoer and a good one are going to act exactly the same. You'll have no way to tell, which if you see the movie Ex Machina, that's one of the things that delves into, is the idea of how do you know? And very, very, very interesting, very good. Just, and it gets into like graphs, and it's interesting in the Audible, like these, they start talking about formulas and stuff, and some of it seems is kind of high level. Nonetheless, really digging it, and we're totally screwed. We're totally doomed.
All right, I just picked it up. As a matter of fact, there it is. There it is right there. I grabbed Superintelligence. I spent my last Audible credit on it, so I'm excited to give that a try.
Sweet.
Yeah, the core idea is that if you have an intelligence, a super intelligence, that's idea that if it wants to increase its efficiency or maximize its utility, it would look upon, it would say, okay, well, I want to cover the entire planet with solar panels. Right. And it's like, good, no purpose for us. Or it could, you give it, he gives these different situations, like, oh, let's say you have one and you tell it, like, hey, your goal is to make me happy. And so the computer's like, oh, you know what? If I just put some electrodes into your pleasure sensor in your brain, and I can make you happy all the time. Or it says, you know what I can do is I can upload you into my system and then put you into a pleasure state and put that on an infinite loop.
I mean, that sounds pretty rad.
I did what you asked. And what more do you need?
Kind of okay with this. So far, so good.
Yeah, this is really amazing. The idea that, like, can humanity survive the early days of you having your TiVo for, like, super intelligence, where it just doesn't quite know exactly what it should be recording? And, you know, like the Patton Oswalt bit. That's amazing.
All right, so I got a question for you, since we have a little bit of extra time. You want to take
also I got another pick.
Oh, great, go.
I saw Hateful Eight,
and
saw the 70mm Roadshow, which clocks in at about 3 hours, including an intermission.
Wow.
I can't objectively review Tarantino films for people that are not Tarantino fans, because I love Tarantino so much. I will say, if you loved Quentin Tarantino, this is basically the all-star game. You have a bunch of people that are great at reading Quentin Tarantino dialogue. They all just say really clever, fun things. Also the N-word a bunch of times. There's all the Tarantino tropes that you know and love, and even in, you know, you even kind of get elements of the past characters that they have that they have played, not in any kind of plot sense, but just in vocal inflections and facial muggings. Like, it just is this super, for me, it's like, listen, it ain't about the movie. I mean, the movie's good, right? It doesn't exactly have the narrative propulsion that that you've seen with other Quentin Tarantino films. However, it is just, you know, tremendously fun to watch.
Did the 70mm projection really pop out to you? Did you visually feel like I'm seeing something fundamentally different from other movies that I watch?
No.
I figured. Because since it was filmed, did you notice any jitter or anything?
I mean, like, it looks like film. I mean, like, I bless his heart. And bless heart everybody who's just got this film boner. But it's like a digital one, and it won for a million different reasons. And like, there is certainly, I assume, a nostalgia for some people that can really notice. You can see the film grain, but is it any different than a million different projects that put a slight film grain digitally over top of their of their shots? No.
Tell you what.
Fargo is a great example of a show that very deliberately at times tries to look of its era, and therefore it apes a kind of film sort of look and puts film grain. It doesn't, to me, look much different than watching an actual film projection.
What about the criticism I've heard that it's very great dialogue, but it's like the most elaborate Quentin Tarantino table read.
Yeah, that's there. I mean, like,
I actually just made that up.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's listen, it is, you know, it's so funny because in the program they give you, it explains the history of The Hateful Eight. And it's like, oh, started as a live read that he did, which is funny that they start there and not at Gawker leaking the script, which led Tarantino to throw a huge hissy fit, say he wasn't making the movie and was only going to do this table read because he wanted to have it out there. And that was going to be it. It was never going to be a movie. So, yeah, it's very talky. It is. I mean, there are times where, I mean, it shows you how great of a director Tarantino is that, like, a bunch of people in a cabin seems as interesting as it is. And it doesn't just, like, shot reverse shot you until you are comatose.
Right.
But it's great. I thought it was super fun and surprises that I did not see coming and I was not aware of.
Quick question. I want you guys to make a quick gamble because we're touching back on stuff that we talked about before, but there's been new news. What are the odds that the number one box office grossing movie of 2016 will be one that launched in 2015? Like, what are the odds that Star Wars makes enough money just in 2016, not counting its opening, not counting the holiday, not counting any of that, just starting in January? What are the odds that its total from now takes it to the number one for the year?
Domestic?
Yeah. Because it's already, I mean, it's stomping. It just, we're recording this on Sunday night, and the word is that it pulled in another $88 million this weekend. So I would include this weekend in 2016.
Yeah, so you got to figure it's got a the top movie of 2016. You've got Civil War looks amazing and awesome. I'm sure that'll clock in really big.
So call it what, 500 million?
Yeah, I think generous. That'd be high end, but yeah. I think, yeah. Then you've got Rogue One, which...
Oh, it's got to compete with another Star Wars movie! That's a good point.
Which will no doubt have the final trailer for 8 on it, right?
Yeah.
And I have talked to people, like, I was talking to my friend's kids, you know, they're 17 and 21. They love Star Wars, super into it, super excited about it. They loved it. They saw it, and they've just been talking Star Wars and Star Wars theories and all that. I'm like, yeah, and it's cool because we don't have to wait long till the next Star Wars movie. And the kid's like, yeah, you know, May 2017. I go, oh no, no, young man. You're getting one this next December. And then I explained to them Rogue One, and I watched this girl's eyes just widen as high school seniors. I'm now like, oh no, there's another one. And this is all about stealing the Death Star plans. Like, really? I'm like, yeah. So kind of cool because if you're a fan, you know, but it's not on the radar of most of the people going in there. And it was smart to not do a preview. It was smart not to split the narrative.
Yeah. Agreed. Speaking of which, I'm just going to assume we're all on the same page that Rogue One will be way, way better than the Star Wars that we just saw, like Episode 7, just because unfettered from the need to, you know, create scenes that rhyme. and to continue stories and make winks to the past. Like, if it's just a really good heist combat movie and there's no force and everything, it's like, I think it could be the best thing ever.
I mean, I think it's going to be awesome. Like, I think now we're in this fun place like we are at the Marvel movies where it's just like, you know, do I prefer Captain America over Iron Man or Iron Man over Captain America? Like, I don't know. Like, I really enjoyed all of them. Like, I think that they're super great. I could see where somebody would be a huge fan of it. You know, the further I get from Episode 7, the more I like it. The more I'm just so jazzed by it, and I'm so jazzed talking about it. And you know, I think Rogue One's gonna be great, man. I think, but like the idea that it'll be better, I mean, who knows, right?
there's the big releases we have to look forward to, Nick, this year are like Rogue One, Civil War, which I'm over the moon for already from that trailer. I just those stories are far more exciting to me than the Avengers stories. This is just more compelling, more interesting to me, and we'll see. And James Gunn says it's one of the best Avengers, or one of the best Marvel movies yet. So we'll see.
Civil War.
Got Batman versus Superman.
Yeah, which, by the way, I remain optimistic. Everyone loves to hate on it. I think there's good chances. Although the trailers, I think they've done a very poor job of selling it to people in the trailers. But I think it could be a rubbery, fun video game version of the DC universe.
There's a review of the film on DC. What was the Reddit? Andrew, it's like DC movie fan.reddit.com
something. Yeah.
Well, I definitely saw somebody had assembled essentially a complete plot synopsis based on all the stuff that's leaked and been put out there.
It actually reminded me so much of back in the 90s with Ain't It Cool News, where you would just get these like, oh, I was at a test screening and I saw the movie. They lay out everything that happens in the movie, and let's just say if fan service is your game, then I think DC people might, whatever flaws might be in that plot might be, they're just gonna put in enough fan service to smooth over the cracks. So,
and I left out X-Men Apocalypse and Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
That might do huge. I think the new Harry Potter, if that's good, that could be gigantic.
There's also the Finding Nemo sequel this year.
Oh yeah, Finding Dory.
Finding Dory.
I don't know. I'm starting to wonder how much of the shine is starting to scrape off the old Pixar chrome. But
Toy Story 2 was pretty good. It was a good sequel to a good movie. I don't know.
It was.
Three.
Cars 2 was not so good.
No.
Yeah. For me, Pixar used to be, every year I really super looked forward to the next Pixar movie. And then it was like around like Ratatouille, I liked, but I'm like, it's not. And it certainly was designed to make critics. I liked it, but I didn't feel like, this is the magical transformative sort of Pixar thing. And then when Cars came out, I'm like, oh man, this is a movie for kids. And it's a merchandising play. It became the number one merchandise brand for several years. And then I still have yet to see Brave or Inside Out.
Yeah, I haven't seen Brave. I really dug Inside Out, but and I haven't seen The Good Dinosaur, but them releasing two movies in a year was kind of a...
Yeah, well, that was not so much them releasing two movies in a year as them finally deciding they had to get Good Dinosaur out the door.
Yeah, that's hard, man. Like, because it's so well worn territory at this point since we've had 9 Ice Age movies, and it's like,
yeah,
it just kind of felt like, well, I mean, you're Pixar. You're like the only people that can have the other movie you did was like an esoteric look into our inner monologues and how they shape our young minds. It's like, and then the next one is kind of like about as animated tropey as you can get, from Land Before Time to Ice Age.
Yeah, it's when you're at the point where if I tell you a synopsis and you can't tell if it's a DreamWorks movie or Pixar or Blue Sky, then
yeah,
that's
then they're not where they want to be. I don't know. I mean, to Brian's question, I don't think.
Oh yeah, Deadpool. We're all looking forward to Deadpool. I don't know if it'll be giant like the other ones though.
Yeah, I think from here on out. So this week, Star Wars The Force Awakens will become, within 3 weeks of its release, the highest grossing domestic box office champ. What it does from here, you got to figure it's got a real hell of a shot at a billion. That seems very likely at this point.
So of which 400 million plus would be in 2016. So unless we're seeing a movie that's going to shatter 400 billion, it seems like there's a chance that could be the case.
But I think we have some potential ones that could do that, though.
Sure. Well, I mean, I guess it's astonishing to me. To me, the story is not whether or not it makes it. The story is the mere fact that there's an argument to be made that that could happen is incredible.
Oh yeah. In a time before prequels, we talked about a new Star Wars should theoretically be the number one movie of all time, and it would have been had it been something like this. And then Avatar came out, and then after Titanic, that was like when the prequels were coming out, like, well, you're thinking, like, this should be Titanic. These should be Titanic. And then you see them, and like, no, this is not going to be Titanic. And now we have a movie that's going to be Titanic, and it's going to be Avatar domestically.
Titanic, yeah.
Yeah, what about internationally?
We will see. I'll tell you what. I have a lot of thoughts about creativity, specifically with the George Lucas interview that I think we should get.
Oh, you know what? Let's take all that to After Things. I think it's a great idea.
We are going to do a retro version of After Things for the fans right after we wrap this up.
Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.